It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. After significant community pushback, Microsoft is abandoning plans for a proposed data center at a site in Caledonia. That's a village in Racine County.
The data center would have been on 244 acres of land surrounded by farmland and residential property. Dozens of people voiced opposition, and a petition in the project has more than 2,000 signatures.
But the company said it is still committed to investing in Southeast Wisconsin, and another site in Caledonia is still a possibility. And that's on top of Microsoft's major investment in a data center in Mount Pleasant at the former Foxconn site.
WPR reporter Joe Schultz covered the story along with another data center project in southeastern Wisconsin. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Joe, I feel like we're all on the data center beat these days. They're all over the state. This thing in Caledonia, what should people understand about this now non-project?
So Microsoft, you know, had been looking to build a data center on about 244 acres in Caledonia, but that land kind of needed to be rezoned from an agricultural district to a light manufacturing and office district. The village, there were some meetings in the village, you know, lots of people signed up to speak. They raised concerns about things like energy usage of a data center and potential water usage issues. I guess it just kind of became clear to the company that this specific site that they had picked, you know, was not popular. So they announced yesterday that they're not going to move forward with the site that they had identified in Caledonia. Racine County officials say that they've been in contact with Microsoft and they're working with the company to try to identify an alternate site in the county and potentially even in Caledonia. But it's not super clear yet what will happen.
We'll hear from the Racine County executive in just a couple of minutes. As you mentioned, Caledonia could come back as a site. Another project you're following is in Port Washington. That's in Ozaukee County. What have you learned about the project? How is it different at this point from what we're seeing in Caledonia?
So the Port Washington project, the big difference between Port Washington and Caledonia is that Port Washington has already approved a development agreement with the firm that's looking to develop a data center campus there. And that kind of, you know, locks the developer and the city into certain requirements. The mayor says that the project in Port Washington is about 6 to 8 weeks from breaking ground. So it's moving ahead. Last night there were a lot of people there were a lot of people at a Port Washington City Council meeting to kind of voice their concerns. You know, one of the things that folks said at that meeting was, you know, that they just didn't feel that they were being heard, and they had concerns about the data center and they didn't, you know, feel that those concerns were being heard by local officials.
There are dozens of data centers in various stages in Wisconsin. Joe, what does this kind of community pushback you're seeing in these communities say about this kind of economic development in the state?
Well, I think there's pushback to all sorts of different kinds of development at the local level, right? I mean, like, you know, listen to a city council meeting if like affordable housing or multi-unit housing is on the agenda, and that'll be pretty evident. In addition to Port Washington and Caledonia, there was a different proposal in western Wisconsin in the city of Menominee. That project was put on hold by the mayor last month. It might just mean that there's more hurdles for communities to jump through to get to build these data centers, you know, and the developers are going to have to work harder to get, you know, communities on board. We see this with all sorts of kinds of development, whether it's housing, you know, community voices, concerns, and then, you know, plans have to kind of readjust. It's just going to make it a little bit more contentious to build these things, I think.
Joe, thanks for bringing us up to date.
Thank you for having me.
That's Joe Schultz, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Now we turn to Racine County Executive Ralph Malecki to talk about the projects going on in Racine County. County Executive Malecki, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning.
I understand you were a bit surprised by the community response to this Caledonia data center. What surprised you about the reaction there?
Well, I am, because on our experience with Mount Pleasant, it's been nothing but a positive experience, and Microsoft's commitment to being basically a great community partner as well as environmentally friendly is what kind of perplexes me about it. They weren't asking for taxpayer dollars to get their building built. And again, in Mount Pleasant, they have formed partnerships with environmental groups like Root Pike Wind to do restoration on creeks and prairies. And it's just been a great relationship. They're stimulating programs at our technical college. And so it just kind of is perplexing to me. And perhaps it's just that location, although I hear there's a lot of pushback around the state with these data centers. Microsoft had a meeting down here a couple weeks back in which they showed us or talked to us about what their intentions are with the data centers and their systems, and that they went so far as to say that electric bills wouldn't go up because of them. They were willing to say that we are not going to increase your electric bills because of us. They might naturally go up as they do without them, but not because of them. And the water usage, they stated that because they have closed loop technology, that they use minimal amounts of water. So it's from that standpoint, it's just kind of perplexing.
Now, that Mount Pleasant one you mentioned, this is the Foxconn site. Was a lot of the heavy lifting there already done because of Foxconn, right? The zoning was there for high-tech stuff, a lot of the infrastructure, the water plans. Did that make Mount Pleasant an easier sale for that big data center project?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Not even a question about that. So the infrastructure was there. The site was fairly prepped already. So, yeah, that was a lot lighter lift.
I want to give a listen to the mayor of Menominee. Joe mentioned a project put on hold there by Mayor Randy Kanak. We talked to him on Wisconsin Today, over $1.5 billion data center construction project. Here's some what he had to say about that.
You know, when the data center comes to Menominee, or when the representatives give their sales pitch, it's a pretty good sales pitch. You know, we can do this, we can do that, and it sounds really good on the surface. But then when you start digging deeper into it, at what cost to the community? And I think that's the biggest concern of the residents is, yeah, there's some good things that can come from a data center, but at what cost to the community?
That's literally the other side of the state there. But there's this kind of skepticism, I think, in some communities that, yeah, that sales pitch from Microsoft or whatever the company might be sounds good, but maybe we're getting hornswoggled here. What do you say to residents who are skeptical?
Is that to
yes, County Executive Malecki.
Okay, what do I say to that? I would say right now, from what I see in the Mount Pleasant operation, that they walk the walk. They talk the talk and they walk the walk. They're doing things that they said they would do. They are living up to their promises. And again, they're getting deep into community involvement without even being asked. They're seeking out community involvement. So from that's what I would say. I think there's a lot of misinformation or skepticism, and that's understandable. But from what I see so far, it's, again, they walk the walk.
We're talking to Racine County Executive Ralph Malecki about economic development in the form of data centers in Racine County one project to ended, but others likely to come. County Executive Malecki, there are lots of different ways, of course, to do economic development in a county. What is the selling point for you of data centers in particular these days?
Well, I can't speak to any other data centers because our experience so far has been with Microsoft. Mm-hmm. And what I see is, again, with the Caledonia site in particular, they're not asking for taxpayer support. They're willing to come in, and their impact would be immediate because it's not in a TID district. So that's what I would say about that.
Yeah, it's a TIF or TID district that would be using, in effect, community money to develop it. If another developer came in and said, yeah, we want to do a data center, but we would need some kind of help, financial help from the county or local governments, would that make it more difficult for you to sell?
We would have to evaluate what that looks like and what it is at that time. So I can't speak to it, but we'd certainly look at it.
And another concern raised by people, you mentioned concerns about electric bills, water usage at these plants. What are you seeing in these data centers when it comes to water usage? What would you say to people who raise those concerns in Racine County?
Again, I can't speak to data centers overall, but I can speak to the Microsoft experience so far. And listening to the Microsoft presentation, they literally can put their data center in a desert. Okay. And what the Mount Pleasant usage was equated to basically four Olympic-sized pools a year. So that's not the billions of gallons that was discussed early on with the Foxconn project or anything like that. It's a pretty minimal usage.
Looking to the future, what are your hopes for Racine County and the Racine County economy that's going to come from that Microsoft project in Mount Pleasant in particular? Because that's a big one.
Oh, I see a lot of economic growth in that area. I do. I see that as an attraction piece to other businesses and supports. And considering that, I mean, we're faced with a shrinking population in the years to come. And to me, this is a big savior of out there on the horizon to develop a develop the development is there. I think it has nowhere else to go other than up, especially with the Microsoft coming to the site.
And briefly, what would you say to people in other communities looking at data center projects, worried about the process? What do you think that you are doing right in Racine County when it comes to Microsoft project to be transparent and let people know what's going on?
That's an interesting question, and I can't really speak to it because the Mount Pleasant site was going on before my term, so that was all started already. But again, from my vantage point, I see them doing nothing other than walking the walk that they said they were going to. So I would take a look at that, and again, I would have to evaluate it company by company, who's presenting and who's coming in, and take a look at it and try to be as transparent as possible about it.
County Executive Malecki, thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Ralph Malecki is the Racine County Executive. We talked to him about a Microsoft data center proposed for the village of Caledonia that fell through after some community pushback. Also, a site in Mount Pleasant, the old Foxconn site that is in the works. We also heard from WPR reporter Joe Schultz.
Coming up, it's cranberry season in Wisconsin, and more than 500 million pounds of these nutritious berries are coming out of the bogs now. Find out what the future holds for this fruit.
Cranberries haven't even had their heyday yet. Tastes are actually changing quite a bit.
The head of the Wisconsin State Cranberry Growers Association, that's next from WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The cranberry harvest is underway in Wisconsin. Our state is the top global producer of this nutrient-dense fruit, and new markets could make the berry even more valuable.
Later, we'll hear from a cranberry researcher who's been waist-deep in the harvest at her family's cranberry farm in Sawyer County in the northwest corner of the state. We'll learn about how these berries come out of the bog.
But first, let's get the latest on the harvest and how economic uncertainty around tariffs could affect our state's producers. For that, we turn to Grant Hawley, Executive Director of the Wisconsin State Cranberry Growers Association, which oversees about 250 cranberry marshes in the state. Grant, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having us. It's the best time of year for us to come on and say hi and remind everybody of all those hardworking cranberry growers that are out there.
And as you lead the association, you have this bird's eye view of all things cranberries here in the state. What kind of things have you been hearing from growers about this year's harvest so far?
It's a tough year. One of the pieces that I keep reminding them. So this year, if you talk to a grower, they're going to say, oh, we're going to be down a little bit this year. And we are, especially when you compare it to last year. Last year was such a banner year for us. Mother Nature was in the best mood you can possibly imagine, and everything lined up. And we had just shy of a record year. Coming off of a year like that, then you sit back and you're like, oh, well, we're not going to do that again. And of course, we're not going to do that again. Our plants are perennials. They can't have a huge year, year after year. That's just horticulture. But I mean, all in all, we're going to have about an average year. Average for us is about 5 million barrels, and a barrel is about 100 pounds of cranberries.
Mm, wow. And do cranberry growers have the same customers now as they did some years ago? Are their customers and markets reliable right now?
They are, especially within the United States, and we're growing our international market at the same time. Cranberries haven't even had their heyday yet, I don't believe. People don't always think about the cranberry, or they feel that it may be too sour or too tart. Well, tastes are actually changing quite a bit. I think a lot of folks are moving away from really sugary flavors, and the cranberry is just so versatile. You can bake with it. You can cook with it. We do see the same customers year after year, even at our roadside stands. Granted, a lot of the folks are neighbors, and they know about the cranberry farmers anyway, but you're usually greeted by your first name, because people have been doing it for so long. A number of chefs throughout Wisconsin are the same way. And then we're just seeing it grow within the entire country as a whole.
There are certainly difficult market forces challenging right now with the situation with the White House tariffs. How does that relate to the cranberry industry?
Well, we are seeing lower prices this year, and that is tough. We are probably going to come just under. So we always have this price that's out there that it's like, okay, are you going to profit? Are you going to break even? We are going to be coming in just under breaking even this year. And we would love to bemoan and we would love to complain, but agriculture in Wisconsin is so tight that we have our family folks that are over in soy, they're over in ginseng. And whereas, yes, we're going to suffer a little bit. Nobody's suffering like those folks right now, and our hearts are going out. So we try to not take up a whole bunch of the news with us right now, but it's not great for us either.
It must be also difficult. It's not like you can plant a different crop, per se. You know, diversifying your crop doesn't really apply to cranberry marshes.
It really doesn't. Our area is made for cranberries. There is no doubt about that. The pioneers, when they got here before Wisconsin was Wisconsin, they found cranberries. They tried to grow other things. We actually have some historical accounts from one of our families that their great, great, great granddaddy sat back and said that it's like, well, we came here and we tried to bring other crops, but the land is more stubborn than the people. And they actually made one of the best ecological decisions that they could have for Wisconsin. And they just quit trying to change the state. And they started to grow what they found here. So cranberries, this is their home. It would be a travesty to take them out and put something else in, because they are native flora. And all of the fun things that go with them, the bacteria in the ground, the fungus in the ground, the critters that walk around, they actually help cranberries because they all evolved together. And they're perennial plants. Some of these vines are over 90 years old. You're not going to pull those suckers out. We have to believe that this too shall pass. Cranberries have been here for 150, 200 years, and they're not going to go away overnight. So we will sort of duck our heads, do what farmers typically do, and we're going to persevere.
With that said, I wonder, are they managed differently than they were generations ago or 100 years ago versus today? I mean, certainly we were much more industrialized. There's much more technology to be had.
There is, and we do employ in a lot of technology, but in almost every case, it's so that we can do more with less. And that's what a lot of folks will use technology for. But we will have some GPS-driven tractors, which actually helps out. We have started bringing in more hybrids of the cranberries themselves. So because we have the hybrids, we can actually string out harvest more. So if we had harvest within 2 weeks, then we need extra people. We need extra machines because you have such a tight window. But if we have some of our species that are going to be ready in early September, some that will be ready in end of September through October and even to the beginning of November, then families themselves can actually handle medium to small sized cranberry marshes, which really helps with the bottom line. And it really helps to keep these as family farms. You'd be shocked how many of our farms are still very family controlled, same families that you had four, five, six, seven generations ago.
Also, I wonder about ocean sprays, their farmers' influence on the industry. I mean, that would, I would imagine, be one of the world's, you know, big cranberry industry producers. How much influence do ocean spray, their farmers have on cranberry bogs and as a market for farmers here in Wisconsin?
Oh, they have a huge impact. You're right. They are easily one of the biggest. The one thing to remember about ocean spray is that it's a co-op.
Mm-hmm.
So this is for farmers by farmers. And even if you look at, say, the Wisconsin board that's part of Ocean Spray, it's made up of members of the WSCGA. And they sit down with their neighbors, whether they are an Ocean Spray grower or not, and they represent all of us. We are most certainly Wisconsin first, and we take care of our community. And Ocean Spray does not fight that one bit. They readily like that. They like the fact that our community is taking care of each other. And to be honest, they help take care of us. When we have needed, say, an entomologist overnight at one of our marshes, if we can't get somebody from UW because the process is just way too, it's too quick. Ocean Spray, whether you're an Ocean Spray grower or not, they usually readily go out and just help anybody. It's very difficult to find an unhealthy level of competition in cranberries, whether you're talking within Wisconsin, within the United States, or even globally. These folks really share their knowledge. Now, people like to crow. They had the biggest crop. They like to bring in the newest technology first, but then they will readily share how they got there with everybody else.
Grant, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for joining us.
Always. Thank you so much for having us and so much for thinking about us.
That is Grant Holley, Executive Director of the Wisconsin State Cranberry Growers Association. We're talking about this year's cranberry harvest in Wisconsin. Now we turn to bogs in the northern part of the state, where growers are busy with the harvest. Allison John Jack joins us now, cranberry outreach specialist at UW-Madison Division of Extension. She grew up on a cranberry farm in Sawyer County. Allison, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me. It is a busy time of year, but it is glad to get to share the cranberry perspective with everyone who'd like to hear it among your listeners.
Yes. And so with the cranberry harvest underway, what are you noticing out in the marsh?
Harvest is, depending on the marshes, of course, we have four major growing regions in Wisconsin, and all four of those regions are seeing a pretty solid harvest this year. We're either just kind of at the halfway point or just a little past the halfway point. And we are looking forward to having our 26th consecutive year of Wisconsin being the leading producer of cranberries in the world.
Okay, so you are in the thick of it right now with harvest.
Absolutely. And so we've seen crops come in. We're seeing pretty solid yields, just about matching what our expectations were going into harvest. Most varieties have had their color come on very well. There are maybe a couple of varieties that are still working on their color, but they'll be there before harvest is over. And so we're quite content with, up until this last dry month, we've been joking that 2025 has been the first normal year we've had in 20 years.
You grew up on a cranberry marsh that was founded by your grandfather over 85 years ago. And I'm wondering what lessons you've learned, or are you carrying your family's cranberry, you know, are you caring for your family's cranberry bogs differently than how they were managed generations ago?
That's a really fantastic question. So as the cranberry outreach specialist with UW-Madison, there are right now seven different faculty members at Madison who have cranberry as one of their major focuses. And so those researchers are always doing, you know, new research I guess I joked that we had our first normal year in 25 years, but heat stress is something that my grandfather never had to have any worry about. But heat stress is something that Dr. Amaya Atucha has been doing research on in the last 2 years and will be continuing for the next 2 years. She's got a major project going on that and how we protect against disease when we have more sun, more heat, and the warmer it is, the more conducive it is for plant disease. So that's been one thing that's been interesting in the last 10 years. Newer varieties. My grandfather planted in 1939 only varieties that were native selections. So basically just taking cuttings from existing marshes where cranberries were growing wild and then planting those and frost protecting them. And we are now, after that first, in the early days, they were all natives. There was a breeding program in the 1940s, and then there was really no new breeding until the 1990s. So in the 1990s, people are on their, now we're on the third generation, so the grandchildren of those original native selections that my grandfather planted. So those are two major first responses about what's changed in those 85 years.
It's really hard to imagine heat stress when all the images we see of cranberry bogs are this watery environment with these beautiful cranberries so plump and just so ready. Can you talk more about the changing climate and what that means for growers in our state?
So definitely, I think cranberry growers, because such a huge part of the cranberry crop cultivation is frost protection, cranberry growers have always been focused on, on the weather, on the climate, on what is going on that they will need to respond to on their marsh. And even though we're also starting to see heat stress in the summers, that doesn't mean that cold stress isn't an issue in the winter. So we actually have to pay attention to both ends of the spectrum and be ready for just about anything. But in the summer, the cranberries actually, they grow near water, but in most cases you have a bed and maybe that bed will be 2 to 3 acres surrounded by, you might think of it as a moat, but we call it a ditch, and then a dike that lets you travel around the bed. And so during the year, they're actually about at least a foot above water level. The growers will keep that water down and they'll reserve that water in a reservoir, or they'll keep it ready for harvest or for that winter flood. So they're mostly, I know everyone thinks of them as being in water all year round, but really they're only flooded for that harvest or for frost protection, occasionally against bugs. But you originally asked about heat stress. And so in the summer, they're growing about a foot above water level. The incident sun, and especially on a day when there's not much of a breeze, if you think of, the same way as you think if you leave an ice cube sitting on your car hood, that will melt. Yeah. And so similarly, if you have just bright sunlight all day, those berries, leaves, breathe through their stomata. Berries have really not the ability to release extra heat. So if you think of like a person can sweat, like a leaf can sweat, like a dog has to pant in order to exchange heat. But berries don't really have any protection mechanism like that, because they evolved in a colder climate. And so we're noticing that if you have too many days where that canopy temperature or the temperature the berry is feeling exceeds a threshold, that berry's cells can start to get damaged, and that can open things up to plant disease.
You know, with Wisconsin being the largest cranberry producer in the world, I wonder, amid these challenges you talk about, will we continue to be the top in the world?
So actually, this is one place where Wisconsin has a real benefit of climate. One of the reasons our growers are as concerned about heat stress and about ameliorating disease as they are is because you consider the other the cranberry growing industries in America are Massachusetts, New Jersey, Oregon, Washington State, and those are all a little bit warmer than Wisconsin still. And so Wisconsin growers chat with their New Jersey grower friends, and the New Jersey growers say, wow, the milder and milder the winters are, the hotter and hotter the summers are, we're having really bad issues with plant disease. And so the Wisconsin growers are actually kind of being proactive, having heard about some of the concerns of you know, the mild winters and warm summers, and saying, okay, if we get, if this happens to us, are we going to be ready? And how are we going to manage those challenges? So I do think that we currently in Wisconsin have enough time to develop good responses to those challenges, partly because we're using the other growing regions as kind of those early warning signs of what to pay attention to.
I wonder, despite the challenges with the climate, challenges with the economy and the markets for cranberries, I wonder what your grandfather would think today of what this industry looks like.
I definitely know my grandfather would be proud to see what Wisconsin cranberry growing has grown to. Wisconsin started producing cranberries commercially in the 1850s, and of course, they're a native plant to our state, so they've been produced non-commercially here forever, or forever since the glaciers. But seeing the huge improvements that farmers have made together with researchers and seeing how far our industry has come, my grandpa would be proud of all of the people who are growing cranberries in this state today.
Allison, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
That is Allison Johnjack, a cranberry outreach specialist at the UW-Madison Division of Extension. And earlier, we heard from Grant Hawley, who leads the Wisconsin State Cranberry Growers Association. Wisconsin is the largest cranberry producer in the world, and we've been checking in on the harvest amid economic uncertainty.
So ahead, a Milwaukee poet searches for meaning in fear and grief with a new collection of poems that reflect on the COVID-19 pandemic.
These poems have helped me to recognize that I do have emotions. I may not communicate them very well with people, but I've discovered them in me.
The book is called When and If. That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Farad. It's been almost 6 years since the COVID-19 pandemic devastated the world. And for one Wisconsin poet, the millions of people who died from COVID still weigh heavily on his mind.
DeWitt Clinton is a UW-Whitewater Professor Emeritus of English. His new poetry collection is called When and If.
It reflects his feelings during and since the pandemic, reminding us that we all experienced the worldwide health crisis together and are still recovering in our own ways.
Here's an excerpt of his poem titled Not Exactly, with reflections on contact tracing.
Heck, it's hard to remember anything yesterday, let alone all the times we've been in contact with someone else out there. So just don't try to make a big deal out of it and enjoy what you have right now, because believe me, and I'm not the only one who knows this, it's more than likely not going to turn out like you hoped it would.
DeWitt Clinton joins us now to talk more about poetry. DeWitt, thanks for being here.
I'm glad to be here with you and all of your staff.
Well, we're going to explore this new collection, but first I'm drawn to what looks like an oil painting on the cover. Can you explain its significance?
Yes, this is a painting. It's from Jeannie Tomasco, who is living near somewhere in one of the suburbs of Madison. It was a delight to find her work.
What does the painting mean to you?
Well, it's abstract and somewhat pastoral and somewhat calming. And those were themes that I thought might be helpful to perhaps get readers to open the book.
You know, When and If is a departure from your other works, and it explores these very personal feelings, complex feelings, especially around the COVID pandemic, which is in our collective memory. I'm wondering, What caused you to pursue writing about the pandemic?
Because I was terribly afraid. That's it. Every day we received, pardon me for choking up, every day we would receive news notices on how devastating it was in so many places of the world, and how hospitals were using parking lots for refrigerated trucks for corpses. It was just scary. Still is. I just got another COVID vaccination shot a few days ago. And I was thinking, I thought this was over. No, I think we'll have this one. And I'm sure people are being infected by COVID as we speak. The book is essentially a Kaddish, or a memorial to all those who did die in the pandemic, as well as someone in my home who didn't die of pandemic, but from other illnesses.
Can you talk about Jacqueline and the grief you had over your wife's death and how this poetry is informed by that?
Well, one thing to add is that while my wife was fading from her chronic illnesses, both physical and mental, and we learned from her last hospital visit that she had serious heart condition that needed to be operated on, and she chose not to. So it was like being a caretaker, and it's quite a fatiguing experience. But she once asked me, when she was still lucid, how in the world can you write poetry when you're taking care of me? Mm-hmm. We talked a lot about death and about where she's going after death. But the one question I couldn't answer was, why am I writing? It was only much later, long after she had died, that I realized, well, I would probably be in a psychiatric hospital if I wasn't writing, because it became therapeutic. A lot of these poems helped me to get through those years. My wife was ill a very long time, years and years. It only increased in early 2021.
I notice that this collection you're writing with very few stanza breaks, and almost in some respects it feels like this stream of consciousness. Why did you compose in this format?
Well, when you compose in stanzas, and sometimes if you're writing formal verse, which I don't write in, you're aware of making something artistic. And I don't think any of these poems are artistic. That might be contradictory. but it's more like spontaneous writing, or what might be called electric writing. In other words, not stopping until you have exhausted yourself, which is what a lot of the poems did for me. They just exhausted my mind. I wanted to compose these so that a person could read them as a conversation.
Yeah.
These are conversations with readers, although I don't know what they're thoughts are. We'll find out if anybody sends a postcard. I think that the writing that I was doing prior to this collection had sort of an objectivity to it. And I hardly ever wrote about any feelings I might have about something. I was always trying to observe without being emotional. I think for decades I would write about something in the world in terms of history or in terms of a text or a painting. That was my sort of place to compose. But these poems have helped me to recognize that I excuse me, Kate, that I do have emotions. I may not communicate them very well with people, but I've discovered them in me. That's a lot.
What are you writing about now?
Just a second here. This is, I'm writing a new collection called Is, Was, Is, which is confusing to people because there once was a present, and then it's a past, and there's something new, the is. So it's looking back a little bit at life, and as well into the future. I think they're more hopeful poems. At least I would hope so.
We're talking with UW-Whitewater Professor Emeritus DeWitt Clinton. His new poetry collection is called When and If. I understand that you've selected a poem to read for us from When and If. Can you give us a bit of introduction and what you brought for us?
Sure. Here is a poem entitled On Reading Luminous Poems in an Escape. That's a Ford model. While outside, Corona drops people off at the curb or at the nearby hospital or morgue. If it helps, the time is early afternoon, sheltered in a covered parking lot, waiting for someone to draw a blood sample of someone else. The wind outside makes everything move in a way that something natural is about to happen. But most are not masked. The storm is coming soon. Everything will be soaked. We have 2 more weeks or months or more of lockdown. The virus may never leave. One by one, it will find us on every continent. In a few minutes, we will make lunch, find a movie set in deep space where we cannot go or even visit, but we decide to go anyway. Each time when we go out, if we go out again, we will measure 2 weeks before either of us falls down and dies. If we don't fall down, we think we can outlive what's out there. But a dear friend tells us just wait. Try to pretend what could never end. And that's just what we're going to do right after lunch.
I hear urgency and just so much movement in your poetry. It just feels like I'm going and I'm moving and there's a lot of emotion. Do you feel that?
Absolutely. Especially when reading it again after writing it a few years ago. The poems are spontaneous. They're not crafted. Some readers might say, well, this isn't really poetry. I wouldn't argue with that reader at all about that. It's something, and the closest thing to it is poetry. Think about spontaneity. Mm-hmm. Think about letting whatever comes into my old head out. And yes, I'm sure there are some grammatical mistakes, as always. There's some fixing up of lines, maybe adjusting the line length so that it fits on a page. But for the most part, I don't think there's any attempt on my part to make the piece that I'm writing artistic. It's more of a outpouring of many emotions.
That might also feel inspiring and refreshing to someone who's like, well, DeWitt's just letting words fly. I should try letting words fly onto the page.
Yes.
What would you say to that?
I would say, let's do that together or try that out. See how you feel. So much of poetry, when you read it in poetry journals or in books of poetry, you see carefully crafted work. I would be the first to say my work is not carefully crafted. It's more a spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings. That's a quote from William Wordsworth. But he also added, reflected in tranquility. There's nothing in this poetry, in this collection, that's tranquil. Recollected in tranquility means in months or years later, William Wordsworth would write something. But if you hear the quote again, the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings reflected in tranquility, the last part I cannot relate to. The first part is everything that's in this collection.
DeWitt, before we close, I'm wondering if you tell yourself ever no more, like I'm done writing about COVID, I'm going to do something else or focus on a different topic. Do you do that at all? Do you compartmentalize topics?
No.
Okay.
I can answer it, your question this way, Kate. I taught Holocaust literature and genocide literature at my university for quite a long time. And when I came up to a last sabbatical, I was proposing another study of genocide as it applies to literature. And then in the application of the sabbatical, I said, no, I don't want to do that. I'd like to look at all the world collections of 100 poems. There aren't very many out there. There are maybe fewer than 100 collections because it's quite a challenge for a poet to put together the 100 best. But I came across a Chinese translation, 100 poems from the Chinese by Kenneth Rexroth. And the first poem was so beautiful. These are poems of the 8th, 9th century up to about the 13th, 14th century. I started writing and I felt like I was under a waterfall because it was so refreshing to me to be not writing again, not studying again the horrors of the Holocaust and genocides everywhere. So I'm sure that my meter will change. I'm always sort of surprised what the next day becomes, because I'm trying to live in the present as much as possible, and it's very hard to, because you're always thinking what you've done and what you're going to be doing. So I look upon life as as a surprise.
Well, DeWitt, thank you for your words. What a pleasure. Appreciate this conversation.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
That is UW-Whitewater Professor Emeritus of English, DeWitt Clinton. We talked about his new poetry book, When and If. He's set to do a reading at Boswell Books in Milwaukee on November 7th.
There's been news lately about a drop in credit ratings or FICO scores, especially for younger adults.
We're going to dig into that issue on the show, and we want your stories and questions.
If you are a young adult yourself or the parent of one, have you run into this? Is it a challenge to get credit for a car or a house? Has it been hard to do some of the things that help get a good credit rating, like finding a good job?
Or if you have advice to share on building a good credit score or questions about it, let us know.
Here's how to get in touch with us. You can send an email at WisconsinToday@WPR.org.
Or you can call or text our message line. That number is 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232.
And then we'd love to include your thoughts, questions, and experiences in that conversation. Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy, Rochelle Wilson, and Avery Lee Rogers.
Our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.